yourself a song to sing and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, the 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, we're going to pick up where we left off. We didn't quite finish our discussion last week on debt and its relationship to financial bubbles, instability, and recessions. So you might consider this part two of that discussion. And we'll jump back into it by reminding folks of the concept of what I have called since 2010 in my book Epic Recession, the debt deflation default nexus. In other words, how debt is related to collapsing financial asset prices that then spill over into real goods prices and into labor input prices, wages, but how the financial deflation, financial asset deflation, I'm talking about stocks, bonds, foreign exchange, derivatives, so forth, how that deflation leads to defaults. And all of these three key variables, debt, deflation, and defaults, at some point in a crisis, feed back on each other and cause a further deterioration of all of them. A default will lead to further asset deflation for that company, which will force that company to take on more debt in order to service its old debt, etc. So it becomes a vicious circle. And they, all three of the variables begin impacting each other in a negative way. That's when you're in a crisis and a downward spiral. Main points from my talk last week, just to reiterate, is that we've had decades long of super easy credit being issued by the central banks, in the case of the U.S., the Fed. This has been going on. As I point out in my Central Bankers at the End of the Ropes book, this has been going on since the late 70s with the collapse of the Bretton Woods international monetary system, wherein the banks then had total control and were the only institution required to stabilize global currencies and economies. So ever since then, we've had central banks, as I pointed out last week, pumping this credit incessantly into the economy through various means, traditional buying and selling stocks, selling treasury bonds and reserve requirement manipulation, discount rates, federal funds rates, so forth. But once the crisis began to hit in the 21st century, this was not enough. And the central bank started introducing what's called QE, quantitative easing, and other measures, ensuring zero interest rates and so forth. So the easy credit, first point, the easy credit, all this money flowing into the economy, which they don't retract very well. The central banks have a hard time getting the money back. They can put it in, but they can't get it back. When they put it in, it lowers interest rates to near zero, excessively low, subsidizing low interest rates. Well, the low interest rates stimulate corporations taking on even more debt. So the easy credit lowers rates, but then the super low rates stimulate even more credit, even more debt. So we get this incessant buildup of debt, excess debt, particularly in the corporate business sector. And we see that particularly with corporate bonds and commercial paper and so forth. The corporate debt market in the U.S. now is over $7 trillion, mostly run up since the 2008-09 crash and the Fed providing zero free money. to businesses, to banks, who then loan it to almost free money levels to businesses. And businesses take on excess corporate bond debt. And the bond debt is reflected in what's called investment grade, which is a higher quality debt that the more profitable, stable companies can borrow at lower, in other words, issue their bonds at lower interest rates, and the bonds will still be bought by investors. But then there's what's called junk debt. And the junk debt, corporations have to lend at a higher rate in order to get investors to buy their bonds. That's called junk bond debt. And it's the companies that are in really economic financial trouble that issue junk bond debt. They got to borrow, usually to pay off their old debt, so they issue more junk bonds at higher rates. There's other reasons why a corporation would issue a junk bond. But those companies, many of them are zombie companies. They're being kept alive and exist only because they're able to roll over their old debt, pay it by rolling over, borrowing new money to pay the old debt. And in between the investment grade and the junk bond grade is called the BBB investment grade, which is the lowest quality investment grade bond debt. If you look at the total investment grade bonds, today nearly half of them are BBB or junk investment grade. This is up from about 30% before the 2008-09 crash. So even good grade bond debt is becoming poor. And, of course, massive junk bond debt being issued. This is all because interest rates were kept so low for so long. Corporations just kept issuing corporate debt. And what did they do with that debt? Well, did they invest it? Well, if you're a junk bond company, you use it to pay off your old debt, you see. It doesn't really go anywhere. But if you are a higher grade company, what do they do with borrowing that money? Do they use it to invest in expanding real goods and services? Or do they use it to invest in financial asset markets? Well, they invested and have invested it mostly into financial assets. In other words, the massive cheap money and the cheap debt that was issued by corporations did not go into expanding the economy. A lot of it went offshore, but most of it went into financial assets, into stock markets and bond markets and foreign exchange and property markets, etc., not just in the U.S., but globally. Well, that doesn't produce any real economic growth. Financial assets are not included in GDP calculations. So all that cheap money, all that investment does not stimulate the economy, but it does stimulate the financial asset markets. It does, you know, increase demand. More money, buying more stocks and bonds, increases demand, increases the price of these assets, and we get bubbles. And, of course, we got bubbles in stocks and bonds and all the other stuff, property at the high end, etc. Financial asset bubbles. Only about 20% of the profits and borrowing went into what we call real investment, which is investment into buildings and structures and plant and equipment and so forth that requires hiring of real people to pay them real wages. Well, if only one-fifth is going into real investment, that means you got low productivity. Low productivity, you got low wage increases. And if you have low wages for workers and low productivity, well, how do we get all this consumption by households? Well, they take on more debt, you see. So the debt begets debt. The debt in the corporate sector begets diversion to bubbles begets household debt, which is over $15 trillion, or about $15 trillion in the U.S. The slow economy as a result of lack of real an asset investment, leads to more government debt as well, as states and the federal government try to stimulate the real investment in the real economy by giving these corporations big tax cuts. So you see how the debt in the corporate sector drives debt in the household sector and in the government sector as well. Right. Really big tax cuts are enacted at the state and local government level. State and local government taxes, corporate income taxes now are like 2% on average. Some places they don't exist at all. So what you got is the government starts subsidizing business because business is not really investing the way it should. And it does that by tax cuts and defense spending. And what you get is a $21 trillion of federal government debt and probably close to that in state and local government debt. You don't see any additions to that, but that's out there somewhere between 10 and 20 trillion as well. So massive spillover of debt accumulation in the government sector and the household sector, which really has its origins in the corporate sector and the lack of real investment. Because there's so much profits to be made quickly and more securely in financial asset speculation, stocks and bonds and derivatives and so forth. So debt has a contagion effect across the sectors of the economy, and we need to talk about systemic debt, looking at the three sectors, corporate business, and households and government. But it's important to realize that the household debt and the government debt is a derivative of the corporate debt. This is where the real dynamic begins and drives the whole system. Right? Now, another point of import from last week was the level of debt doesn't matter if you have the cash flow or revenues to pay the principal and interest on it. Okay, so where do you get the cash flow for your business to pay the principal and interest on it? Well, you can sell more of whatever it is you're producing, goods or services. That generates more revenue, which creates more cash flow that enables you to pay the principal and interest. Or you can raise your prices. Now, it's kind of hard to raise prices when you have an economy that's not growing robustly. And that's been the case in the U.S. until just recently, and it's still the case in Europe and Japan. So if you can't generate more income and cash through revenue, through price hikes and or selling more volume, well, then you simply have to roll over that debt if you can get a bank or a financial capital shadow bank to roll it over for you. Okay, so that's, or you can get the government to subsidize your debt either by having the central bank buy up your debt, which is going on in both Europe and Japan, buying corporate bonds. You know, or you can get tax cuts from the government to offset the cost, the higher cost of your debt. Okay. So if you're not generating more sales or price increases, you're not generating the profits and the cash flow, therefore, in order to service the principal and interest on your debt. And that leads to further borrowing that raises the level of junk and triple B corporate bond debt. And of course, the same thing goes on with what's called leverage loans, bank loans, which is kind of like junk loans. And also the terms and conditions of the debt may be eased by the banks or the lenders. These are called covenants. They lower the covenants. In other words, a loose covenant would guarantee that the bank would roll over your debt. a strict covenant would say, no, if your debt reaches a certain level, you're not going to get any more to roll it over. And then, of course, you know, is your debt, what's the interest you're paying on the debt, and what's the term structure for the debt? Is it short-term or long-term? All these things are other technicalities that influence your ability to roll over your debt and pay the principal and interest on the debt. The problem occurs for corporations and businesses, right, when their sales slow or they cannot raise prices to generate the extra income, cash flow, to pay the principal and interest on their debt. And if it looks bad for them, they can't get the loans or the reissuing to roll it over. All right, this is where we got to last week. These are the main points, right? It's credit that leads to massive debt. The corporate sector drives it. It's been diverting its borrowing and debt to financial assets, creating bubbles. There's a contagion of debt across from corporate to government to households. The level of debt's not important. The question is, can you continue servicing it, paying principal and interest? But that means, do you have the cash flow and income from price increases or sales volume? Well, when those two turn down, when a recession in the economy, the real business cycle weakens, well, then you got problems with sales volume and you got problems with price hikes. And if the Fed raises interest rates, which it has been, then you have problems of rolling it over and borrowing even more at a higher cost, and the banks won't give it to you because you're already weak. Then you have a problem. So it's a question not of the level of debt, it's a question of ability to service it, which is the question of, do you have the cash flow, the income, and can you borrow if you don't? If none of these things are possible, if you can't roll it over, and if you don't have the revenue stream, then you end up in what's called defaults, right? Debt deflation, I just described, the consequence is defaults when you can't service the principal and interest. Now, defaults affect the real economy very seriously because when a company defaults, it usually lays off its workers, all or in part, and those who remain get a wage cut. And other investors in other companies see this, and they start getting worried, too. You know, we used to have a concept, run on the banks, right, where everyone would come down and say, we want our money out, right, 1930s, because the bank down the street failed. Oh, you may fail, too. I want my money out. Well, when you ask your money out, your bank fails as well. Well, there's something similar to that when we have defaults, except it's not necessarily the banking system. It's the whole corporate capitalist economy when you have defaults. Right? Well, when there's defaults, there's also a psychological effect. Good companies or companies that aren't really in default end up in default as well because of contagion, psychological contagion. Mainstream economists often do not pay enough attention to these psychological effects, particularly among investors, to some extent among households. But they don't pay attention to it because it's hard to quantify. You see, they only want to deal with real numbers. Well, you know, the psychology is the key for investment, but their models don't factor in that. That's why one of the reasons why their models are so poor as far as predicting is concerned. A default also leads to a total collapse of the remaining assets. If a company is default, doesn't pay its principal and interest, or either, or both, right, it is in default. Well, if it's in default, then no one wants to buy their bonds. No bank wants to roll it over. In other words, they're dead in the water. And their only option at that point is to sell off their best assets. You get asset fire sales, right? They start sloughing off the best parts, the best money-making parts of their company, which is a temporary solution because it really dooms them longer term. During the last crisis, a good example of this was Citibank, Citigroup, right? had expanded globally. It went bankrupt, technically, in 2008-09. The government, too big to fail, they wouldn't let it fail. They underwrit it and Bank of America with $300 billion. But they required Citigroup to start selling its assets worldwide that it had overloaded itself in the previous decade with. And it began to do that, to raise money capital, to continue paying its principal and interest on its debt and other operational costs it has. So when a company starts selling its prime assets, you know it's almost dead. You know, it's on life support. It's full of the wires and other life support by the markets and the government, and it's doomed. So, what else can happen when a company defaults? Well, not only selling off its best assets, but it can be forced into restructuring and reorganization by the owners of its debt, usually the banks and investors. Well, what do we mean by restructuring? Well, you know, they force it to become a different company. They sell off parts of it and raise cash that way. And in addition, they reorganize it as a smaller company or a different company or whatever. So, you know, massive reorganization, restructuring, as well as asset sales. And then in a real worst case scenario with defaults, it goes to bankruptcy court and the court sells off the assets. And that's really super fire sale prices. So defaults are an indicator of growing financial fragility. The level of debt is an indicator, right? But the ability to pay the principal and interest on the debt and falling in real income to service it are also indicators. But when the defaults start happening and asset sales, sometimes the assets fire sales occur before default, is a last-ditch effort to stave off the default and the bankruptcy. But sometimes, that's insufficient, and the asset sell-off occurs after default, either in the court or the lenders of the bonds themselves get together and they do their stuff. Okay, so defaults are an indicator. Right. Now, you can have defaults on the household debt side, too, right? That failure to pay principal or interest, right? And student loan defaults are very high right now. It's $1.5 trillion market. Auto defaults are rising significantly. We don't have a big impact yet on mortgage defaults because most of the home sales in the last 5 years have been high-end sales. Or sales by foreign representatives coming into North America and Europe, i.e. Asian money, driving up the price of homes by taking their money out of China and wherever and investing it in properties in the U.S. Okay, so households can default, credit cards, over $1 trillion now. But those default rates are just rising slowly, except for student defaults. The federal government can't default. At least the U.S. government can't default because it just prints the money to bail itself out if it needs to. Right? States and local governments, however, can default and sometimes do. And we have a number of states in the U.S. that are very fragile. Connecticut, Illinois, and some of the others have massive debt and obligations, liabilities, and they're prime cases of the next crisis having more default. So the government can't default. States can default. Households can default. But that default is the consequence of the global crisis and corporate defaults. Households usually default when they lose their jobs because households, the primary source of income, their cash flow is their job. They have very little investment. So when they lose their job, they're in trouble. And there's something like a third of all American households, at least, who have no savings whatsoever. They're living paycheck to paycheck. And, you know, they lose their job, they don't make their payments, and they default on credit cards, usually first, and then autos, and then their homes. So defaults in the household sector are usually a consequence of the spillover of the corporate level problems. And then the government tries to stem the problems of collapse of income in the corporate sector by giving them big tax cuts or subsidies. In the household sectors, you know, increasing unemployment insurance, and but not much else. So not much bailout of households, but a lot of bailout of businesses by the government, which the bailout raises their debt level, you see. Well, what are the indications of default beginning to appear? Well, Sears, clearly in bankruptcy, or about to. Some billionaire or partial owners trying to get more loans in order to reorganize Sears into a smaller company and take another shot at it existing. But he's having trouble. He's having trouble getting other investors and banks to give him the money, you see, even though he's willing to put up his own money. You know, investors know that Sears is a dead duck. There's no way Sears will ever make it. But we see similar problems now in other big box retail stores. JCPenney. I always predict JCPenney is the next Sears collapse. Recently, his stock price has collapsed 50%. That's a good indicator that the company is on the way out when you get that kind of a massive stock contraction. It means investors are pulling out their money out of the equity market for the company, and because they see it, it's pretty much doomed. Well, Penny's is doomed as well. But now we see Macy's as well having problems, and Kohl's and so forth. Macy's holiday sales were negative, flat or negative, and its stock price now, as it predicts further profit declines, is collapsing recently here this past week. So all these big retail companies are in big stress. Well, why? Because they've taken on a lot of debt, a lot of corporate debt, to stay alive during the last 10 years. They're loaded up with debt, a lot of it junk debt, triple B debt, and investors see that, they're not going to make it long term because Amazon is undercutting them fairly well. Retail companies that have been able to mimic Amazon to some extent, like Walmart, are surviving. But those that haven't, Sears, Penny's, Macy's, late trying to do it, but not successful enough, they're in deep doo-doo. Right. Another indicator of default potential, perhaps even more significant than the retail sector, is General Electric, once the biggest company in the U.S. General Electric is like the Citigroup of 2009 and 10. What do I mean by that? Well, as I said, Citigroup had to start selling off its prime assets everywhere around the world in order to get the government subsidy so that it could keep hanging on. And GE is in the same boat. GE is selling off its prime assets everywhere, raising cash in order to pay its principal and interest on its debt, you see. Raising cash because its sales are down and it hasn't been able to raise prices for years, okay? Except for the government work that it does, which is, you know, government pays them prices for their defense goods and raises their prices no matter what. But that's not enough. GE is too big a conglomerate, and even the government sector. It makes submarines, I think GE does. And for a while, they made jet engines. I don't know if they still do. But GE is selling off its assets everywhere. And, of course, when investors see the assets being sold, what do? Oh, this company's in trouble. Let's sell our stock, which is happening, and that means the stock price begins to fall. We're seeing problems similar just beginning to emerge in the auto industry. General Motors and now Ford have announced massive job cuts, thousands, tens of thousands, and Ford is dumping its European operations. And Ford, the company that created the family sedan, the Model T, right, now has announced it will no longer make sedans at all, just trucks and SUVs, which are trucks with a back seat, okay? So GM and Ford are in trouble here at the beginning of these trouble. And it's not just GM Ford in the U.S., but, you know, the German companies, auto companies, and so forth. The same situation everywhere. Offshore as well, U.K. retailers and auto companies are in trouble. Housing prices are collapsing over there. Its economy is slowing down something less than 1%. And if there's a Brexit here in a couple more months, it will go negative. And we see problems growing for European banks, even German banks like Deutsche Bank, Commerzbank, Danske Bank. These are all signs. These are all signs of the march towards default. And when you see these big companies default, it sends shudders through the rest of the financial economy, and investors start pulling in their horns and stop lending or raise their rates significantly to lend. And I'm talking not just about the banks, but the shadow banks, the capital markets, in other words, you know, investment banks, private equity, hedge funds, and so forth. By the way, hedge funds are had a very bad year, a number of them, making bad calls on the economy. And other sectors of the shadow banking system, which is not unregulated, you see, unlike the commercial banks, they can go. They can have a crisis here before the commercial banks. Okay, the U.S. the Federal Reserve recently issued its first financial stability report not too long ago, and you know the message from that was a warning about corporate debt. Warning to investors, and yes, that's a problem. Corporate debt is a problem, and that's the crux of the problem. And it's mostly, I think, it's not a bank corporate debt. It's not the banks this time around. It's the non-financial, the non-banks. And the markets to watch for financial instability are the junk bond market, corporate junk bond, the BBB investment bond market, which is really a junk bond market, and junk loans called leverage loans. And a few others. Former Federal Reserve Chair Yellen, not too long ago, also raised concern about the leveraged loan market. Watch out for that. And we even got Larry Summers recently this past week to issue a warning about recession coming. You see, recession coming. So we're starting to get red flags and warning signs, even from mainstreamers and the business sector, about problems in the economy. Problems. Now, Trump is trying to blame the Federal Reserve, Chairman Powell, for all this because of raising rates. Well, yes, he's been raising rates because 6-7 years of free money has created all these bubbles, and the Fed knew that it needed to retreat a little bit from all the free money and the subsidization of corporate profits. You see, all this free money amounts to subsidization. The free money is not to bail out the banks. The banks were bailed out in 2010, but they continued for 6 more years. With free money. And that just created all these bubbles and subsidized these companies, including zombie companies. And the Fed knew it couldn't continue this because the bubbles were about to get out of hand. So it started raising rates. And, of course, it knew it had to raise some rates, too, to give itself a cushion to lower rates should the next recession occur. And recessions always occur. And it was already 7-8 years from the last one. So the Fed started raising rates. And there was an understanding, you know, that when Trump won, okay, we know Trump is going to come with a massive fiscal stimulus in the form of tax cuts for corporations and businesses and the wealthy, hoping that by giving them more money, they will trickle some of it down into real investment. So the Fed knew this was going to happen, that the subsidization of capital incomes was shifting from monetary policy to fiscal policy, tax cuts. So the Fed started raising rates. The Fed believed, correctly, if it continued its free money under Trump, and Trump threw in trillions of dollars of tax cuts, that would overstimulate the U.S. economy. If it would or wouldn't, who knows? So the Fed started raising rates, just as Trump started cutting taxes massively. The subsidization of capital shifted from monetary policy to fiscal policy. Okay. Well, the real economy is weakening, you see, because of the Fed rate hikes. It's not the trade war. Trade war is not impacting GDP, U.S. or China, very much at all. You know, it's a phony trade war. I've been talking about it, and there will be an agreement with China and the U.S. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But I've been predicting that since the war became public, erupted last March 2018, that this was a phony trade war. All the steel aluminum tariffs were just a stalking horse. By the way, there have been like 4,000 exemptions to U.S. companies from the steel and aluminum tariffs. Yeah, they pass these tariffs and then they exempt all the companies. It's an indicator of phony trade. The South Korean trade deal, the first out of the barn, was a phony deal. You know, there's no tariffs. I mean, South Korea is one of the top three steel importers to the U.S. And what happened there? No tariffs on steel. Just some token stuff about auto quotas. What about the NAFTA agreement that came after that? Really a more smoke than mirrors, right? Yes, there are steel and aluminum tariffs still held in abeyance with all the exemptions by Trump. But that's to ensure that the Canadians and Mexicans don't strike separate deals with China so China can come in through their back door into NAFTA. Once the U.S. comes to its agreement with China, which will be before the summer, then those tariffs on steel and aluminum, Canada and Mexico, will be lifted as well. By the way, I published an extensive analysis and evolution of the Trump trade war from March through December in the latest issue of the World Review of Political Economy. You might want to take a look at that, formerly the fall issue. And I've updated that and put that on my blog, jockerasmus.com. Part one, part two will soon follow of that. It's a rather lengthy analysis, 7,000-8,000 words, but it's my summary of what this all means, this trade war. And I've talked about the trade war with China here. We're at the cusp of that, but we aren't really in a trade war yet. Notwithstanding the tariffs, 10%, 25%, on tens of billions of import goods in both directions, and the latest, $200 billion, has been suspended by Trump until they can get an agreement here. And they're intensely negotiating now. Trump's representatives just went over to China. And as I understand it, the second in command over there, Liu Yi, in China, is coming over to Washington before the end of the month to really get into negotiations. And the slowing economies in the U.S. and in China, I think, are the main force that will drive the two to some sort of agreement here. In the agreement, China will give the U.S. what they want on buying more farm goods, $100 billion they've already offered, and at the same time give U.S. bankers access, 51% ownership access to China, which is what they wanted. The big stickler is and has always been technology. But I think they'll come to a wording on that that will allow Trump to say, see, we stopped them. And at the same time, China will agree to wording that he can work around in the long run. So even the technology issue, I think, will be resolved. And we'll see an agreement. But nonetheless, the China economy is slowing, not because of the trade war, but it is slowing, probably closer to 5% than 6%. The U.S. economy, I've been predicting, as I did, I think it was last week, that we will see a significant slowdown in the first quarter of 2019, as it always does in the winter. It might get another boost a little bit in the second quarter, and then we'll slow down. And there's a good possibility, better than half, that we will enter recession by the fourth quarter in the U.S. Because if you look at the indicators, the housing sector pretty much stalled. If the Fed stops raising rates, that may give it a little boost. The auto sector flattened and is negative in certain parts, Ford and others. Mass layoffs coming, as we said. Manufacturing indexes in the U.S. are approaching 50, which is no growth. We've had a big business inventory bloat here in the U.S. Businesses have overproduced goods because they wanted to get these things out before a full-blown trade war began. So we've had an artificial stimulus of export production, which will have to be adjusted here in 2019 in the other direction. So business inventories and therefore real business investment will slow, may even approach low single digits. And then we see continued Fed rate hikes. On that question, I've said Fed will raise interest rates at most one more time in March, maybe not even that, but at most that. But we see the stock market, U.S. stock market, had its worst November, December since 1931. It's recovered some here, but it will slow again. It's definitely, the momentum is down. But it was a significant, almost, 10-20% contraction here in November, December. You got to keep in mind, all these problems that are beginning to appear in the slowing of autos and housing and manufacturing and inventories and stock market and so forth are coming, coincidentally with the greatest massive subsidy, the corporate profit bottom lines in U.S. history. Trump has boosted corporate profits with his tax cuts alone, windfall, by 27%. The S&P 500, 27% corporate boost. Massive. There would be very little corporate profits this year if it wasn't for that artificial windfall. from the Trump tax cuts, which, you know, it's all gone and front loaded here in the early years, has gone to businesses, corporations, non-corporate businesses in the wealthy 1%. It's going to be paid for in subsequent years by raising taxes on the middle class and by some phony assumptions about 3% plus growth for the next 10 years, which is, you know, just absolute ridiculous. And that's how they get this 27%. Well, you know, this 27% boost here this year, first full year of the tax cuts, Trump tax cuts, compares with 2017, his first year, where profits rose about 10%. I'm talking about S&P 500. And before that, in 2016, profits were actually flat. And before that, 2010 to 2015, corporate profits ranged between 5 and 10% a year. So massive, massive subsidy, fiscal subsidy. The massive monetary subsidy ended. The massive fiscal subsidy through tax cuts began under Trump. Okay. Well, there's consequences for this massive subsidy. And that's one of the reasons why the Fed started raising rates, because it knew this massive subsidy on the fiscal side was coming. And they thought, well, okay, we could raise rates. And Trump and the Fed also believed that the negative impact from the rate hikes would be more than offset by the positive impact from the tax cuts, that businesses would take these hundreds of billions of dollars that they got this year in windfall tax cuts and invest it in real goods and services, creating jobs and so forth, which, of course, as I said, maybe one-fifth only ended up in that direction. So the tax cuts have not offset the negative impact of the Fed rate hikes, combined with slowing global economy, combined with possible trade war and other effects here. Even the supplemental $200 billion in defense spending by the government has been insufficient, because defense spending does not generate that many jobs and that much GDP anymore. It's mostly high-cost technology, low employment needs, and so forth. Well, you know, it just came out last week. What's the deficit for the first quarter of the current fiscal year as a result of the Trump tax cuts? $317 billion deficit. Cutting revenue. In other words, a 41% increase in the U.S. deficit compared with the year earlier. You know, the U.S. Fiscal year starts in October and goes through September. So we got a full quarter here, first full quarter, and we have a $317 billion deficit, mostly because of the tax cuts. You see, taxes are responsible for two-thirds of the deficit. It's not spending, it's tax cuts. Well, at that rate, what we're going to see is a $1.3 trillion 2019 deficit. This is unheard of. In the so-called booming economy of 3% GDP, we've got a deficit of $1.3 trillion. I mean, think of it. This never happened before. Well, it's occurring because it's a phony artificial stimulus, and it's not having any effect, or very little effect. At the same time, we have a trade goods deficit of $800 billion. My apologies, I'm still trying to recover from the flu, which has been dragging on for over a month. So, $800 billion trade deficit, a $1.3 trillion coming budget deficit. Oh, well, Trump is doing so well. Well, all he looks at is the stock market, you see, and even that now is going south. We got a little bump here in January. None of this stuff going south occurs in a straight line. What are the fiscal and monetary responses to this deficit? and the apparent slowing U.S. and global economy. Well, they're in a bit of a quandary here. One, they have to raise interest rates, the Fed does, in order to attract capital, money, investment in treasury bonds and bills, in order to pay for this $1 trillion-plus deficit. That's why they're raising interest rates. And to some extent, they want to create a cushion because they know the recession is coming as well. To some extent, they don't want to overstimulate the economy monetarily because they've already done it through tax cuts. But really, the real cause for raising rates is to pay for the debt. But there's a contradiction here, you see. If you raise rates to pay for the debt, you're slowing autos, you're slowing housing, and other sectors of the economy, which create a bigger deficit. See, reduces tax revenue collections and creates a bigger deficit. So it's self-contradictory to raise rates. Well, business has been putting pressure on the Fed to stop raising its rates. And the Fed has complied. You know, Powell's recent statements, Chairman Powell of the Fed, has given clear signals. Okay, we're going to be patient. You know, that's the signal. That's the word. We're going to be patient with further rate hikes. And several board governors, Fed board governors, already indicated, well, maybe we should stop. So now the debate is whether the Fed will raise rates at all in March or not, and then, of course, for the rest of the year. But, you know, the Fed listens to the financial markets. Really, truly, it listens to the financial markets. And it's listening now. And it always has listened. You know, it's a fiction to say, oh, the Fed is independent of bankers and businesses. No, no, no. The Fed has always listened to bankers and businesses. In fact, there's a revolving door between the governors of the bank, the Federal Reserve, Central Bank, and private banks. Been going on a long time. Revolving door. So the influence of the private banking system on the Fed is very subtle, indirect, opaque. But it's there. It's always been there. In the beginning of the Fed, it was more obvious. You know, they didn't try to create any kind of a fiction that the bank was not, the Fed was independent of the private bankers. You know, this fiction about central bank independence really comes in the 1950s. And it's been growing because the bankers who really influenced the Fed and its strategic direction, not day-to-day, but its strategic direction, right, don't want the politicians interfering with that influence that they've had since 1913. So this whole central bank independence theme is always expressed in terms of congressional or presidential influence, attempt to influence the central bank. It's never about the bankers influencing the central bank. You know, which is really the case. So now we got this renewed talk of central bank independence, you know, and the Fed, Trump, you know, criticizes the Fed publicly. He's not going to intervene, but he criticizes it because he wants to place the blame for the recession on the Fed, off of his back and onto the Fed. He knows the Fed, you know, is not going to bend to what he wants. The Fed will bend to what the bankers want. And the bankers want a slowdown of the rate hikes because it's impacting the economy. The rate hikes are having a bigger negative impact on the U.S. economy than the Trump tax cuts are having a stimulative effect on the U.S. economy. That's the reality. So the bankers are saying, you know, to the Fed through their governors, whoa, whoa, slow down, right? Here, you're going to really cause a recession. We all got our tax cuts. That's all we want. You know. Now slow down. All right. That's the fiction. And you can really see what's going on elsewhere in central banks in the world. You know, the U.S. Central Bank suspended its QE, quantitative easing policy, in which it provided officially $4.5 trillion to the banks, way after it needed to bail them out, free money, $4.5 trillion, by buying bonds from the banks, buying government bonds from the banks, and buying mortgage bonds from the banks. That was QE. An official number in 2016 was it peaked at $4.5 trillion. Well, that's the Fed debt, you see. That's on top of the government, $21 trillion. Fed debt, $4.5 trillion. Well, actually, it's more than $4.5 trillion because the Fed kept rebuying the bonds from the private sector as bonds began to mature and roll off its balance sheet. So really, total money injected into the economy is probably like $5.5 trillion, right? And the Fed, when it said it's going to stop QE and start reducing its balance sheet to $4.5 trillion, what it's really said is it's not eliminating QE. What it's doing is not rebuying the bonds as they roll off and mature. So QE is still there, you see. It's just that they're not rebuying it. Well, how much has rolled off in 2 years? Well, 400, 500 billion out of the $4.5 trillion, right? And that's coming to an end because when it rolls off the bonds, allows them to roll off, it's really reducing the money supply to some extent and causing interest rates to rise. You see, it's not just raising the federal funds rate. It's also QT, quantitative tightening, rolling off the bonds from its $4.5 trillion debt. Still $4 trillion. Well, what's the ECB, European Central Bank, doing? They announced that they're going to slow down their purchases about, I think they're still purchasing $30 billion or $50 billion a month. They're going to slow that down and not purchase anymore at the end of the year and start letting it roll off. So, you know, QE is not dead. QE is still there. You know, and all this QT tightening is just not rebuying the bonds as they roll off. Bank of Japan is even worse. Bank of Japan is not only buying government bonds, but it's buying stocks, private companies, right, and corporate bonds. European Central Bank's buying corporate bonds. In other words, they've been subsidizing the corporate sector by purchasing bonds, keeping the price up, and stock keeping the price up. Bank of Japan is not even trying to provide any fiction that they're going to slow down at all. They're just going to continue. The capitalist state is subsidizing the private sector even more and more than ever before. Okay, so that's the monetary response. The fiscal response is still a question. Okay, this is Alternative Vision. Next week, what are the red flags being raised by researchers and corporations and business itself?